Rock and roll. Hello to everybody who may be out there somewhere. We are reconvening after coffee in the usual post-coffee chaotic mode. But we're ramping up and getting ready to go. We now have, as you see there at 10:50 on the agenda, a visit from representatives of the nomination committee. And we thought we'd invite them to thank, yes, that's helpful. And we thought we'd invite them to tell us a little bit about what the NomCom's up to and what it's looking for this year and how we in civil society can participate more and so on. So I'd like to turn it over. Who's going to start? Yuriel? So we turn it over to the chair of the NomCom, Monsieur Yuriel.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having us here. Good morning. I have to make sure it's morning, not evening. My name is Yuriel Länsipuro, the chair for NomCom this year, and I want to give you basically three messages. One is, and perhaps the most important, is that we need good candidates. Without a good candidate pool, there's nothing we can do. And that's why I'm appealing to you. Please apply, and please tell those people you know could be good candidates to apply. The second message is that we need your help in selecting the people for GNSO, and as you know, there are two positions, one in each house, and all ideas of what kind of people would be good counselors would be very much welcome. And the third message is about NomCom itself. It's been said that NomCom is a black box and always has been and always will be, and it is not true. Starting with this NomCom, 2013 NomCom, things will be different. Yep. We decided in Toronto at our kickoff meeting that the process will be as open as possible, but data, that is to say, the names of the candidates will be confidential. Strict confidentiality of the names is the absolute basis for our work, because otherwise no one would apply. But it should not be used as an excuse for keeping everything secret. I mean, like we would be a bunch of, you know, cardinals who elect the Pope, and then white smoke comes out and everybody says, "Aha!" Yeah. So we try to change that. And we've been implementing that in two ways, maybe more later. But first of all, we have been issuing report cards. That's to say, report cards are sort of collectively drafted immediately after each meeting, phone conference, or physical meeting, and then each representatives of each constituency are relaying them to their constituencies, of course, with their own comments if they wish. And this, I hope that this system works with you, and that I'd like to hear if you're satisfied with that. And the other way by which we have been implementing this principle of openness is that there are open meetings of the NomCom. First of all, our meetings are noted on the set schedule of the ICANN meetings. Before, they used to be like the meetings of the, you know, the Soviet Politburo. I mean, they were not mentioned, not even in the Pravda. But now, now they are, and two of them at this meeting are at this time are open, That is to say, yesterday we had the outreach subcommittee meeting chaired by Cheryl, and today at 5 o'clock in room 5BC, we have the meeting of the full committee, and you're all welcome to come and see what we do. In addition, of course, there will be the traditional NOMCOM open workshop, which is basically our last opportunity to recruit people and do outreach. Well, of course, you know, there are going to be three board directors we select this year, two for GNSO Council, one for CCNSO Council, and three for ALAC. And the ALAC people, one will come from Africa, one from Asia, Australia, Pacific Islands, and one from Latin America, Caribbean regions. So these three things are what I wanted to tell you, and as I said, I would be happy to have your feedback, but perhaps, I don't know if Cheryl would like to say a few things, who is the chair of the next NOMCOM.
Thank you very much, Yuri. Cheryl Langdonor for the record, and I am the current chair-elect, and we assume, as I said this morning in an earlier meeting, providing I survive this year, I'm assuming I will be the chair of the NOMCOM next year. Look, this is a huge opportunity for us, and I just wanted to remind you all, and we will get into some details momentarily, but I need to get this through to you right now, and that is you don't have to send to us or encourage people to put in SOIs that are just fodder, perhaps, for the GNSO. If you think you've got someone you can tap that would be the equivalent to an independent thinking, a non-aligned, a not the usual suspect person, ALAC's got those three regions. You know, we need not just the people who are involved in those pretend sort of silo edges that we all try not to work in too much, but if you've got an idea for the CCNSO Council, you've got someone in the CCTLD community who is engaged as a civil society member, not someone who's running their local registry, because that way their pathway would be through their CCNSO channel, but someone who is in the civil society in a particular CCTLD, then send them our way. Right? So don't only think your own place and space, think right across all of those. And other than that, thank you for the opportunity of speaking.
Thank you. So just to review, three board members, say it again slowly so that don't know if it resonated with everybody. Two GNSO, one CCNSO, and three ALAC. Okay. Now, for the GNSO, I think it's fair to say that some of us who've been on the council in the GNSO in the past have felt that the NOMCOM appointees often came more from a private sector orientation, and that this has impacted the way the voting works, because, as you know, we're divided up into these four stakeholder groups, and basically the balance of power is held by that one person that's put in by the NOMCOM. And in recent experience, that balance of power then has been systematically held by the commercial stakeholder group. And so from our standpoint, I think one of our priorities would be to ensure that the NOMCOM takes seriously some truly independent, balanced, maybe somebody from a non-business-oriented background for this kind of a slot. And we will certainly, what's the time frame is
first
May 1? We'd have a lot of time, but we could try to identify somebody who might be a plausible candidate to fit in there. Beyond that, that's the local point. I take your general point that we shouldn't only think just about that, and that civil society people can fit in and for the board slots and so on. I wonder also, we have a representative on the NOMCOM from the NCUC, one. Perhaps he has a thought or two about the relations between the non-commercial world and the NOMCOM process and ways we can leverage it and so forth. That means you, Rafiq.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think what how NCUC can help is to reach, I think we have also many new people coming today, is to reach all their networks and to encourage people to apply from the non-commercial world, and to so we can have a diversity, not just business drive, I'd say, people with, as you said, people with business background, but more diverse background, and also to guarantee geographical and gender diversity. So more we have bigger pool of candidate, more it will be easy for the non-com to select, to appoint those who can assure that diversity. And as you talk about the openness of the non-com, I was sending several times every month the report of the non-com activities, and I really hope that NCUC member, if they have a question or they want to send a feedback, so I can bring it to the NOMCOM. And especially we discussed about the issue of this, the issue of the appointing an NCA in which house, and it's quite a critical problem, I think. So we have suggestions. Okay, so to explain the Geneso structure, you mean, or
okay. No? But there have been these substantial politics over whether and how the NCAs get placed.
Okay,
in the GNSO, and whether it's something that NOMCOM does or whether the GNSO does it, and the result of it thus far has not been a civil society friendly.
Okay.
So I just wondered if you could say a word on it.
Okay. So I think before the restructuring of GNSO, that's happened maybe 4 or 5 years ago. So before it's still we the NOMCOM appoint three members to the GNSO council, but after the restructuring we have two houses, the non-contracted, where we CNSO is there, and the contracted parties, and so we have two voting NCA, one in the contracted and the other one in the non-contracted, and one what we can call a homeless NCA. So the problem that with the restructuring, there is the threshold for the voting. So in the case of the non-contracted party, we have the non-commercial stakeholder group and the commercial stakeholder group, and that NCA. And NCA can be tiebreaker in the voting. So it's really important to have an independent person, not someone that he can be more close to one of the parties. So we are not asking, I think, here in NCC to have a non-commercial, but someone who have the independence and the background that led him to get all point of view and to vote with in his own capacity, not really in systematic way to one of the parties.
Understood. I've got Wendy, but first Adam sitting next to me from the NOMCOM. Wanted to add something?
Yeah. Adam Peake, just to be clear about this, the NOMCOM is limited by the ICANN bylaws, so we can't act beyond what is in the bylaws. So, you know, we do the best we can, and that does mean reacting to the candidate pool, but the rules are there in the bylaws that we have to respond to, and of course we can't bend those. Thanks.
Fair enough. Wendy, are you ready?
Just very briefly, Wendy Seltzer. I think we'd like to see on the council nominating committee appointees who couldn't have come through the stakeholder groups, and we've tended instead to get people who should have been through the groups, and that's led to bias in the voting, because well, we'd love for everything to happen through consensus. Just about everything in council does happen through voting.
Hartmut, did you want to add something? Just to underline, okay. So,
yes. Cheryl here, just on that point, this is where we get to say back to you, remember, we can only choose from the puddle of people we have. Therefore, if we've got the material to work with, we hear what you say, and we hear that from nearly everyone we speak to. But when push comes to shove at the end of this filtering process, if there isn't anyone who has that particular criteria, we then have to make another choice. So providing good materials there, we will do our best with your request.
Understood. Joy?
Thank you. And I appreciate the repeated focus on the pool of candidates. Just by way of feedback, I think it's also useful to reflect on and consider the performance of some of the NOMCOM representatives as a way to sort of just help them lift their game, in particularly around the GNSO Council, I think, where, you know, we've seen, certainly in terms of the record, a lack of confidence, I would say, in active engagement in debates around the council, and I worry that even with the quality and the caliber you've got, there's a need to grow the advocacy voice there. I fear that the NOMCOM representatives actually aren't clear necessarily on what their role is, and I just simply see numerous meetings where the NOMCOM representatives actually make no input whatsoever. So. For whatever the reason that is, having got good candidates there, we want to make sure they contribute. And so reflections on that and how to engage on that, I think, would be useful to get your thoughts on.
I will say in my 4 years on council that when the NOMCOM people spoke, very often a lot of people, that was time to check their Facebook pages because some of them just took forever to say nothing. And really were not engaged in where the issues were, or else were just perfunctory aligning themselves with another dominant party. So we really need high-quality people prepared to come in and think for themselves. And I'll come to you in a second. One question I have about that is, though, when you look at possibilities, when you look at the possibilities for the GNSO, do you think to yourself, well, it's got to be somebody who already understands the GNSO and is fully in on the dirt of how that works, or can they be somebody who's relatively newer? Because, frankly, a lot of the people who are already going to be deep into the process stuff are going to be people who are already aligned with one of the groups. So just wondered about that point.
Yeah, just briefly. Of course, it's preferable that that people know about internet and the structure of ICANN and so on and so forth, but they can come totally outside if they are otherwise well qualified.
David? Yes, go ahead.
Just to totally sort of change the subject here. So last year the NCUC rep on NOMCOM ended up resigning towards the end of the process. We don't want to part the veil that hides NOMCOM deliberations. But obviously we don't know that much about the incident because that privacy of NOMCOM operation has been respected. But we do know that our rep resigned, and there was some, it seems like fairly controversial inside NOMCOM. I'd like to know what NOMCOM has done in its procedures in order to prevent repetition of that problem, which is difficult to do without really describing what the problem is, but I would still like to basically answer that question. What procedural changes, or how are you dealing with that issue?
Well, I don't know if we're supposed to comment what happened in the previous NOMCOM, but anyway, I was a member of that NOMCOM, and what I can say is that there were long and really deep discussions after we had performed our actual job on how to prevent any kind of conflicts that would damage us and hinder the NOMCOM from working in an optimal way. How to do that? There were a series of recommendations from 2012 NOMCOM to this, and they are in public domain. They are on NOMCOM site, and in our kickoff meeting in Toronto, we we studied them and we adopted our present rules of procedure. So that's what I can say, and not really going back to the details of what happened last year.
I think it's Cheryl for the record. It's important to recognise every NOMCOM is a fresh start, and that is why they review their rules of procedure at their kick-off meeting. But do rest assured, or as assured as you can, appropriate material, which is set in the public record, provided by the previous NOMCOM for our consideration, was looked at, was discussed, and if you want to compare and contrast rules of procedure from one year to another, you're free to do that.
I'm confident that this NOMCOM understands the problem that happened and will guard against it happening again. I think we've run out of the time that we have scheduled. Did Milt, do you have something very pressing? Or just two last real quick comments from Milton and Adam?
Just a question, actually. Is it still the case that the commercial constituency gets two representatives and the non-commercials only get one? And if so, how can we change that?
Yes, it is correct that the business constituency places two delegates to the nominating committee. There's a representative of large business and small business. It's also worth noting that the NPOC, as a new constituency, does not have a seat. And the only way to change that is to change the bylaws, because the structure of the nominating committee is a bylaws requirement, so it means a discussion about the bylaws. I've attempted one informally as myself, not a NOMCOM member, but somebody interested in this process, and not got very far yet, obviously, because the bylaws haven't changed. But it would be something that you would continue to discuss with the board, and specifically, I believe, with the SIC. So take it to the SIC. May I carry on and just finish? We're talking about recruitment, and we need your help and advice. There are two ways to do that. The nominating committee website follows the typical ICANN standard of the committee name, ICANN.org. So if you go to nomcom.icann.org, you'll find our webpage. And if you want to apply, if you do /apply, you will take yourself to a statement of interest form, which is our application form. I will note that that application form is online. It does not save. So as you're going through it, make sure you've got all your information in a separate document. Do not think it's being saved, please. And if you wish to recommend somebody, and this is particularly important, we have a process for taking recommendations, nomcom.icann.org/suggest, you will go to a form which allows you to suggest somebody's name, and that can either be anonymous or it can be with your recommendation going to that person saying, I, Adam, recommend you, person X. And that will come to the NOMCOM. It's very helpful because it encourages somebody, somebody actually likes me enough to say, you go do that job. Or it might be that they don't like you enough. But anyway, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much for visiting. We really appreciate it. Best of luck with the rest of your meetings today. Okay, now we need to return to our schedule. I would like to talk about the workshop tomorrow. We were on the question of programs, if you could go down, scale down. To the programming, the Beijing event. The link is broken, but can you go to the proper link, which is, after all, on Confluence and the NCUC webpage? Go to ncuc.org. Then click wherever Wilson put the link. Or you could do the link that's on Confluence. No, I sent the links out to you. Would you like me to email it to you again?
Just while you were doing that, I've had a request to show to a reminder that we promised to show a video or something. Thank you, Brendan.
Do you want to show the video while he's trying to find the link? Show the video. This is a little video that was made for our publicity purposes. And I've just emailed you the link again.
So, is Bill...
Say who you are.
This is Brendan Kurbis, for the record. So, as Bill was mentioning, this is something that we developed mostly to kind of help explain what NCUC is, because a lot of people coming into the ICANN world really have no idea where non-commercial people go. So hopefully this moves us along the path of kind of explaining that. And, you know, it's videos can be a very effective and cost-efficient way of doing this, so this may be the first and maybe a long line of other videos we can use to do things like explain complex policy issues in a short amount of time. So here we go.
This was produced during the Toronto meeting.
Yeah, in advance, this was produced in advance of the Toronto meeting. It actually was the result of a lot of contributions from a lot of people in NCUC. Maria Farrell and I helped develop the questions for the people that were interviewed. Numerous people were interviewed there at the Toronto meeting. And then on the editing side, both I and Milton contributed to the editing. We worked with a producer that's based out of Toronto. And it was done on a shoestring budget. So here we go. And tons of time, tons of volunteer time.
Future historians that look back and go, you know, there was that time in the 1990s and 2000s when citizens of the earth built this open distributed network and everyone could communicate with each other freely, and then it all shut down. An organization like NCUC has a special obligation, as do all of us who care deeply about protecting and preserving cyberspace.
Since the founding of the non-commercial users constituency in Santiago, Chile in 1999, we've been fighting for fair use, free speech, freedom of expression, privacy.
ICANN plays a key role in determining how those human rights can really be enforceable in the internet.
When we talk about a multi-stakeholder community like ICANN, you have representatives from government, from law enforcement, from private industry, each of which might bring their own agendas and interests.
Particularly the intellectual property interests, people would say, are overrepresented.
What ICANN consists of now is a bunch of people running around the board, screaming at it, trying to get its attention.
Decisions at ICANN are made by the people who show up and the people who scream most loudly.
So it's really important for civil society to get involved, because we need to balance that. We need to bring the kinds of human perspectives and human rights issues into these policies.
NCUC in many ways is the most diverse.
We have over 200 organizational and individual members from more than 60 countries.
NCUC, it's a good way to show how open, diverse, and participatory internet debate could be.
Getting involved in NCUC is a great way to expose yourself to this environment of global governance and to empower yourself.
Listen, you got to get involved in this ICANN thing because it's important. And if you don't get involved, you're going to find the internet becomes a more constrained space.
Organizations that are committed to non-commercial speech on the internet and are involved in using the internet for their own advocacy and outreach should definitely join NCUC. And they should bring their energy and their ideas, and we'll teach you how to participate in ICANN, and you'll help us create good policies.
We'll now open nominations for Best Actor and Thank you.
just one proposal. If you add a voice, it would be good to add a voice from Africa.
Or from the leadership.
That, yeah, we're taking on board all of that feedback. Thank you very much. We did what we could with the resources we had at the time. So, and we'll do it more.
And I'll put my Brazilian jersey from the national team next time I speak on the video, to just make sure we are from the South.
Yes. Sorry.
Before we leave it, Brendan said something really important that I wanted to add, which is that this might be part of a series, not just about recruiting people to NCUC, but about summarizing some of the very complicated things we do in a minute or two video that we can put out there, and I think that's great. There's so many issues that we're working on, and it's hard to do the outreach and to do the policy making at the same time. So this idea of videos that will help us gather comments and commenters and people from outside our process to work on some of these policy issues, I think is a great idea. So, yeah.
The budget requests are due in 1 week. The budget lit team is open to participation by anyone. You can reach the budget team from the ncuc.org website. If you think that this is something that we should ask for funding to do, then please, God, get on there and make a proposal.
You're serious? The budget's due in a week?
Yes.
Okay.
This is what I've been trying to tell people. Good. And we were debating whether budgets are bad. The budget is due in a week. Okay? So, returning now to where we are today. We have a reception tonight at 6 p.m. at the end of Constituency Day that will be held in the Grand Foyer, Grand Hall Foyer B. We have discovered, interestingly, that ICANN is holding a reception next door at the very same time. So that's a little bit unfortunate, but hopefully people will bleed back and forth between the two events. We should have some flyers. Are there flyers for our workshop? Are they all gone? They've been distributed. I don't know if we can find more. Hopefully we'll put out more. The idea is that people be made aware about tomorrow. So anyway, so we have a workshop tonight, and if you could scroll down, David, I'd like to just go through the program briefly. So tomorrow, the whole focus of the conference is a One World, One Internet, New GTLDs and Competition in a Changing Global Environment. And this is operated with the support from our friends at CGI.br, PIR, .org, and Internet Society. Hi. And we have two panels that are going to have to move very quickly. And we have not had an opportunity to really talk amongst ourselves about exactly how these should be calibrated and focused. And I wondered if the chair, we don't have the chair of the second one, but we have the chair of the first one, the moderator, Wolfgang Kleinvector, is here. It'd be good to try and tune up as a group a few ideas about what we would like to achieve with this panel. What concepts? You have 1 hour and six speakers, so you're only going to be able to ask a few questions and take a few rounds of reaction. The first point is they need to know, I hope that you've been in contact with them, that they're not all coming with prepared speeches, because it should be an interactive talk show kind of thing. I found out last night that somebody from one of the Chinese organizations was preparing a speech, which is not what we wanted. So hopefully that the rules of the game have been made clear, and I just wondered, could we talk a little bit about what this panel will talk about? Wolfgang.
Yeah, thank you very much. You know, this panel, this 1 hour, wants to raise the issue of the risk that the Internet becomes fragmented. I think the ICANN slogan, One World, One Internet, is now rephrased again and again and again, but it's also questioned by some other groups. We had a workshop in the WISIS 10 Plus in Paris where one of the panelists from China said, that's not right, we have different worlds, and we have also different internet. We are behind the firewall. And so that's why we have the question mark between one world, one internet, and we in this panel, you know, I want to ask some questions to the panelists, you know, how we can keep the internet as one internet in one world, so we have no chance to escape to Mars or Venus, so that means we live on this globe, but we should recognize there are differences in cultures, in languages, also in jurisdictions and all this, but this should not block our understanding from one world and one internet. So that means the question mark should be removed at the end of the panel, and we should say, yes, we have one world and one internet. That's why I have invited people who are very close also to the government. Tarek Kamel was a minister in Egypt. And so I think the Arab world, there are some plans to, you know, have a separated internet for the Arab world. I have invited a former advisor to a Russian prime minister, and Leonid Todorov. So there are, in Cyrillic, there are some plans, you know, how to get this more or less separated. We have a guy from the Ministry of Information Technology from China, and we have Markus Kummer from ISOC, which has a different slogan, which says, you know, one world, internet for all, so, and not one internet. So that means I want to question this, you know, how ISOC sees this, and I hope we have a vivid debate, which at the end of the day comes to the conclusion that we should witness that there are some tendencies towards fragmentation, but we should encourage to do all what we can to keep the One World, One Internet slogan a reality.
Thank you. Wolfgang, how do we, in the time that we've got available, how do we avoid this just degenerating into the repetition of tired generalities about the glories of openness and avoiding fragmentation? What are the specific kinds of points about sources of fragmentation that you can draw out, in particular the local speakers on, and where are the sort of points where we can put the pedal to the metal and get real on the issues here? That's what I want to know. If you have a thought.
I think that's...
Or if anybody else has a thought.
I would be very happy to get some additional input, you know, how to focus the first question. So I want certainly... I plan to ask first Tarek Kamel from ICANN to explain how ICANN sees this with his background and how ICANN sees some dangers and risks, you know, that the internet becomes fragmented. And then I want to go from this to our Chinese partner. By the way, there will be only one representative from China now from the ministry, because the director from the Internet Society of China will miss, so that it's a little bit easier also for the panel. We are less people, so we have more time for interaction, and I hope also that we get some questions from the audience. But please, you know, if you have any recommendations, you know, what to, how to focus the debate, that's the right place to give me this feedback.
My suggestion would be to, as we look at the layout of the panel, we've got ICANN and ISOC people who are going to give us the kind of standard rah-rah integration, all one world, glory of the single root, blah, 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 that's fine. And then we're going to have people from China and Russia. And we know the Russians in Wicket proposed that there should be a recognition, international legal recognition of the national legal space for a cyberspace, and that this should be subject to global regulations, etc. We have the Chinese approach and what they're doing. It'd be good to try to draw them out on the specific kinds of steps
yes.
that they're taking and how they're thinking about the question of integration versus fragmentation.
I think yesterday in the Chinese summit, which was after around lunch, the guy from Russia, the Russian center, Andrei Kolesnikov, raised again the issue of the YANA contract and the single route, and said we have to talk about the logistics of the YANA. So I think this would be a very concrete point to say, you know, whether there are plans to ask these questions, which is for the moment settled by a contract which goes for the next 5 or 6 years. So So, and I want to squeeze out whether there are some plans, you know, to challenge this.
Mm-hmm. Does anybody else have any other thoughts that perhaps you could throw on the table? Joy.
Just a couple of thoughts. I mean, I think certainly in other forums, what civil society groups are discussing is the increasing risk around, in fact, the actual fragmentation of the internet. You know, I mean, the reality is here in China, people don't have access to the same internet that people do in other countries, and increasingly we're seeing, you know, large-scale filtering, content blocking, and other things which even ESAC here has said in its issue paper 56 does pose threats to the security and stability of the root. So, I mean, you know, I think if we're going to try and get something beyond the platitudes of how, you know, there is this one great model and all we need to do is secure and protect the multi-stakeholder bottom-up process and all will be fine, then I think we need to inject some strong reality check on that in terms of civil society perspectives. And I know I harp on about it, but, you know, Egypt did shut down the internet, and we've never really had an equivocal, clear statement from Tariq, you know, on that. And it's troublesome in terms of ICANN's role in, you know, saying it has a technical mandate, and yet, you know, the reality being what we're seeing in other forums being really, really significant risks to that. So, you know, okay, we know that. We know there are sensitivities in this context, but I think unless we have some kind of provocation around this, we're not going to get beyond some of those platitudes.
Well, the point was to at least try. Yes.
I mean, it's getting closer and closer to my Walid al-Sakaf, to my domain, because I can't actually access my own website here, so
right.
It's a really interesting experience.
It's a little frustrating,
but I mean, it's also good to ensure that we don't, you know, bring in the subject quite critically. It's a matter of approaching the subject with an understanding of circumstances in the country, because if you're talking about the multi-stakeholder approach, then we, as within this context we are in right now, there's the government and there's civil society, supposedly, and there's also the business community. So these need to be, you know, attracted to the subject. But without having them attracted, we'll only have one side. So I'm not sure we're going to go far if we talk about the subject from quite...
Well, of course, we're not here to put the host country's feet to the fire and make things uncomfortable, but at the same time, we should be able to have some open dialogue. And if you like to stand up and ask why you can't reach your own website, see if anybody has an answer, I think that's entirely appropriate.
Thanks for the suggestion.
Could we talk briefly about do you want to say something just on this?
Well, yeah, if we don't put the host country's feet to the fire, who in ICANN is going to do so?
Yes, the exalted role of NCUC is recognized by all, but at the same time, not greatly appreciated by staff, leadership, and others who have been in contact with me asking that we not misbehave. So we have to walk a fine line here. They're trying to open an office here, and
which
China is
doing.
Part of their business model, and so I'm not going to walk in and sort of misbehave. Yeah, so anything we do has to be done with a certain amount of diplomatic finesse and balance, I would suggest. And the idea was to have a balanced panel here that would present different viewpoints and invite the Chinese colleagues to reflect on the views being shared.
Did anybody consider inviting the GAC representative from Taiwan?
No, we did not. All right. So now, and you, by the way, are copied on the, you're on the program committee, and you never suggested that. So now for the second panel, Hong is the moderator, and she's not here, but Milton is sort of the intellectual architect of this panel, and so I'm going to ask him to perhaps do the same thing that Wolfgang did and give us a little taste of what are the kind of organizing ideas that we're asking people to engage around here and see if people have any feedback.
Yeah,
Yeah, the organizing ideas are the regulation of the domain name industry, and particularly the issues of competition and privacy as they intersect with domain name regulation. So in particular, China has expressed at various points, sometimes not too officially but indirectly, an interest in having some kinds of special authority over domains that are in Chinese script. On the other hand, from a purely sort of business standpoint, you know, a domain is a domain, and trade in services are services, domain name services are domain name services under the WTO agreement, probably would be classified as an information service, and there would be no discrimination in treatment based on whether a domain is in Chinese or Cyrillic or ASCII. So we wanted to bring that issue out for explicit discussion. But we also want to sound out the attitudes of CONAC and CNNEC towards competition with each other. Will there be more competition in China because of this, or will this be one of these sort of managed things where they get something and the other guys get another, kind of a carefully divided market? And to what extent do the Chinese representatives believe that greater and more intense competition in this field will undermine their attempts to use the domain name system as a way of controlling what they consider to be bad behavior on the Internet? So you may or may not be aware of the fact that there is... I thought I would raise some of these questions in my own presentation. And I've already talked to Lee May about some of these issues. I haven't met the CNNIC guy. I should probably try to track him down if Hong can. Did you invite Hong to this discussion? Okay. So what was the other? Yes, so the CNNIC domain had was becoming one of the largest domains in the entire world. It would pass to .de. And then there was a crackdown in which they literally, I can't remember the exact number, but it might be as much as like two-thirds of their registrations were canceled. A very large number of their registrations. And this was because they were cracking down on what they saw as spammers, cybercrimers, and other bad actors. Including like BitTorrent sites and those kinds of things. So there's two interesting issues there. One is the trade-off between a growing industry and the highly regulated. You know, how much of the market are you sacrificing? And you can see the market share of .com going up as CNNIC cracks down, which I think is...
I don't mean to interrupt, but I was just trying to get to, like, crisply stating the kinds of questions that we would ask. You're kind of giving your presentation, which is interesting. But so just so we know how to how we're driving the discussion.
The crisp statement is there. What is it you'd find inadequate about that?
I want to know when Limu Lu and Zhang Tang Sun looks at that, what they're going to think they're being prompted to say.
Perhaps we're done with this agenda item since we don't have the other panelists.
Wondered if anybody had any input on how we might focus this panel. If not, then we'll move on. Okay. Well, I strongly encourage everybody to come along. I think there'll be interesting discussions, and hopefully there'll be good coordination and preparation in advance. We talked to somebody last night who was preparing a speech, and I hope that they've since been told not to come with a prepared speech. Okay. Well, it's a question of how it's being introduced, and so the moderator will have to manage that. No, I understand that. There is interpretation also. Okay, so that's the event tomorrow, and I hope everybody can come along. We've got 10 minutes until the PIR people come, so I think why don't we hold the bylaws conversation until after that, and before that, finish up the other loose items on here. We have a couple of other team-based efforts in launch, various stages of launch. We formed a team on inReach and member engagement, and another on outreach and recruitment. These are obviously two sides of the same coin. Perhaps they could be folded together as just member relations, but for right now, that's how they're specified, and Ed is the facilitator of that. We also want to start to do some communication stuff, and I've talked with Mary about perhaps helping lead on that, and I have a couple of points I want to share on that. So first, quickly, why don't we go to Ed and see if you have a couple of comments on inReach and outreach, what you've been doing and what your plans are. Sure. Sure, they're coming in 10 minutes, so.
Go for the slides. We'll be doing some speed talking. Can you update it? Okay. We've held off on launching these committees because we had to do some revitalization within the infrastructure of the NCUC. When we took over, we really had no way of admitting members. Members would come through the NCSG, and we wouldn't even know they existed. We didn't know what members we had. When you applied to join our family, you would go to the NCSG and come to our website, and we'd ask you to join a website, not a constituency. And I know I wasn't brought on board to be a webmaster. So in terms of outreach, and David, we're going to have to just go real quick, if you could. Next page. Oops, if you can. What we're waiting on are some resources. The website's going to be up. Bill's going to be talking about funds he's requested to produce a brochure. And I'm working with Mary on creating a fact sheet that is key to internationalization of our community. We want to use the fact sheet and translate it into as many languages as possible with the basics. Who we are, what we do, how to get involved, the benefits of getting involved. And the ideal is that inside the brochure, we'll be able to put the fact sheet in the native language of a country we're going to, say for an ICON meeting. When we have the event in Buenos Aires, for example, we'll have the brochures, but we'll have a fact sheet in Spanish, and we'll be able to reproduce that in as many languages as possible. Next. Okay, different types of outreach, and sometimes we don't clarify what we mean by the term. We have the public outreach to increase our membership, but we also do IG outreach and ICON specific outreach. And one of the proposals we'll be making is we need to involve more public outreach when we do events at ICON events. When we have Milton 3 days before the event asking, where are the flyers? And I'm going to an English-speaking event on Sunday morning with 250 English-speaking diplomats, civil society folks, and I have no flyers. It's really hard to say we're doing outreach at this event. We're doing outreach, but to a limited degree. We're going to fix that. Go for it. All right. Different types of outreach. We have the general outreach, which everyone's been doing. We also have targeted outreach. As we've been waiting for the other stuff to come up, that's what I've been focusing on. We got a few pilot projects. Go. We had a great pilot project in Russia. Unfortunately, the nature of volunteerism is that volunteers leave. But we have about 40 individuals and organizations we've identified that are potential candidates for membership of NCUC. This whole project, we're going to try to reproduce in different countries. And it came from our Brazilian friend, Magali, who told me, Edward, you sent stuff in English to us. You're in America, or in my case, the United Kingdom. No one's going to respond. So what I'm trying to do is get people on the ground. We had somebody in Russia, translate our stuff in Russian, and then we do the cold calls via email to those organizations to see if it works. The second pilot project, David, next one, professionals. It's called affinity marketing. We're going to start with some IP folks. We've gotten some feedback that, hey, we have too many IP members. My argument is we don't. We have too many American IP members. I don't know if we have any civil society IP lawyers, and there are more civil society countries in the world than there are common law nations. So we got a list of about 40. I've asked Kathy and Mary to help out with a joint letter saying, hey, IP folks, we're NCUC. This is what we do. Please join us. So we'll send these things out with that attachment, and we'll see what happens. If you can go on, we're doing the same thing. We're going to be trying to follow up in Spain, France, and Italy with Nuno Garcia leading the effort. If you can keep going, Pilot Project 1B, Librarians and the Access to Knowledge Movement, and Ray has a few extra letters at his name, Roy, basically in Miami at St. Thomas University. He's leading that effort and has already been making calls. Next, please. And Sam, Kathy's son Sam, is leading a youth effort. The youth have adults talking for them, and Sam made me realize in Prague, maybe we need to have the youth talking for themselves. Some of us have met some of the kids from Hong Kong here. Really bright. I have the cards, and Kathy, Sam's going to get the contacts to follow up. And Sam's really upset he's not here, and he doesn't think he should have to go to school this week, as you well know. And I do agree with Sam. We needed him here, and tell him that. Go for it. Okay, this is big, because, as I said, waking up on Sunday morning with Milton yelling, where are the flyers? And it wasn't the first time he yelled that. And then it was Brandon, get me the flyers, because as we all know, when things go wrong, we always yell for Brandon. This is what we'd like to do in Buenos Aires, where we think we're having an event. First of all, we can't rely upon ICON for a room. That's going to be a discussion elsewhere. I've briefly talked to Robin about it. We got to get it set up a month or two in advance. We can't be saying, are we going to have an event 2 weeks out and expect we can do public outreach in the city the meeting's taking place? Then the timetable's there. 6 weeks out, we contact the targets. 1 month out, we contact civil society media. And then 2 weeks out, we start bombing them with emails and reminders. That's a way to do public outreach at ICON meetings instead of just having outreach to ourselves, which tends to be what we do, ourselves and other constituencies. Go. Okay, as Bill's brought up, the IGF, there's been some talk that we need to put a little bit of pressure on the nice folks in Brussels and Washington. We may at some point, and this is far down the road, try to do a standalone event in D.C., introduce folks to ourselves, let them know we exist. That's something, again, that's in the future, but something that we have out there. Go for it. The one thing we can't forget, we talk about people. Bill's real proud, as am I. What, 75.8%, I believe, of our membership is non-American. But we sometimes forget they're people. So let me personalize this a bit with one of our newest applicants. Go for it. That's Maria, and I used the photo with her permission. She's in Nicosia, Cyprus. Go. She produces, under her own domain name, this Cypriot Human Rights blog. Go. She also has an English language newsletter that she comes out with every week. That's how I got to know her. I found the newsletter. It's fantastic. I made contact with her. We've been emailing back and forth for a few weeks. Then, was it Sunday night, Monday morning, or one of these nights here in Beijing? I was up for 3 hours with her. We went back and forth. She finally applied to join. Now, here's the deal. There are 2 billion non-commercial internet uses out there. If I have to spend 6 hours with each and every one of them, my life, I would love to have that life expectancy. So I want to conclude. If you can go, David, one more. We're going to have a referral box on the members' web pages where basically, let's say you're sitting at home and watching a TV news show and you're thinking, they should be with us. I want you to go to that box and put down, try to find these people. You know, this organization, this individual. Send it to us. We'll do the recruiting. And we now have an email address, ncuc@ncuc.org, where if you have anybody out there that you think we should be targeting, any ideas of how we can do outreach, and please, if you'd like to join our committee, contact us through that address. We'll get back to you, and we'll try to bring more people in so we truly become the voice of individuals and civil society in ICON, whether ICON wants us here or not. Thank you.
And I see Brian has already showed up, so we'll make this relatively short then and then turn to the PIR welcome discussion. But so as you can see, Ed's bringing to the game a lot of energy and interest in trying to stimulate outreach to new people, and we can all help by trying to target particular groups. There are a lot of folks that we could sit down and map out and identify as potential and members and write customized spins for why they should want to be involved. But then once you bring them in, you've got to like show them how they can actually do stuff and why it matters. And so that means also the in-reach part.
We have a presentation, which we don't have time for, but we are doing in-reach, and we're doing a serious study led by our mayor in Norway to try to find out, for example, why 90% of our membership is inactive. That's not something we can do quickly, but it's going to take time, but we are putting together a study plan to do that.
Okay. Just when we use terms like inactive, it's worth bearing in mind. There's, you know, in civil society coalitions like this, you've got different kinds of dynamics. You've got people who join, and they're willing to vote for and support representatives who engage in processes, but they don't necessarily have the time to go work in those processes themselves. And then you've got people who actually want to transition towards getting more engaged. And, of course, it's difficult. It's difficult for non-commercial players who don't have any financial skin in the game and don't have staff and all the other goodies to want to put a lot of time into deep diving into ICANN work processes, etc. We can do more, though, to try to facilitate that process, show how it works, show what the benefits are, show that if you get really engaged in a working group and you start to play an important role, that we might be able to allocate some of our travel funds to support you, to get you to the next meeting, these kinds of things. But all that has to be sort of laid out. We never really had that specified. So it's a matter of just architecting that and recognizing that different people are going to want to participate in different ways. Some other things that we want to try to scale up. Are you waving your hand? Okay. Just because I know Brian's here and I don't want to go on too long on this point. Just some other things that we want to start to scale up that we haven't had a lot of time yet to work on is a new communications effort. And I think Mary can help with that, and certainly anybody else too as well. I put in a fast-track proposal that's being considered now, and we'll find out in a couple of days, for just $2,000 for print materials. We have no print materials. We have no brochures or any kind of newsletter or anything that you can lay around that's a nice, shiny thing that says, this is what NCUC is. And I thought we could do maybe like a brochure or even some concise issue briefs that would be presented before the quarterly meetings or the three times a year meetings that would perhaps identify a few key positions that we're taking and some contact information and things like that. When I look around this table, we got a room full of people who write for a living. I've looked at by example. Can you click on that example? This is going to freak you out. That I would actually show this will probably make that link. It doesn't work. Well, I don't know what's going on with these links. But anyway, it's the brochure from it's the newsletter from the BC, and you've seen those floating around, and they have a lot of like smiley, cheery, la-di-la-di stuff. We don't necessarily want to do something like that, but we could do something more substantial with a little bit more of a critical bite that says who we are, what positions we're taking, and what we think are the key issues for this meeting that's coming up that we're pushing. It would not be that hard to do this. So anyway, I put in a fast-track request. If we get resources, we could try one as a pilot for Durban, and if we decide that we want to do more in the way of communicating our message, who we are, there's a lot of misunderstanding of that, who we are, what we're about, and so on, through different mediums, we could build that into a budget process, which, again, is due next week. Milton.
The newsletter, the bottleneck is not resources. It's somebody's time and somebody having the time to read that. Yeah, and nobody is going to get more time if ICANN gives us money. I'm sorry. You can't hire some flunky to write up, have a full grasp of what's happening in the Durban meeting and write up an analysis of it and understand where we want to. That would have to be you, Bill. And resources, I don't think, you know, it's a question whether you have time to write something like that. And in terms of duplication, it's trivial. It's trivial. You want to send me a PDF and I'll bring a 200 copies and they won't be late this time. You know, it's not about resources. The time that you spend preparing a proposal to ICANN for something like that would probably exceed the time you would save from whatever resources they gave you.
Your opposition to resources is noted. In any event, so the point is, I think we can do more in the way of printing materials that reflect who we are, and that's one of the items that we want to consider going forward. So that's that, then, those three items very quickly, and now we have, we're very happy to have...
Kathy
has something, and then Brian? Okay, then Kathy, I didn't see your hand, sorry. Okay, your fearless leader's been pushing this on ICANN staff and leadership for 4 years. They showed no interest in it. Well, I'm going to respond. And in Los Angeles, we raised it with her, and she has been turned over and turned entirely into a staff-driven process with the community locked out. So I'm willing to try to do that again. But the problem is that they have not shown interest in engaging us.
It would be worth trying again.
We can keep doing it. Then there has to be a group that works with Ed, who's the head of the outreach group, to try to put, to keep this going with Sally, because so far what she's told us is that they've defined theoretical models and constructs for outreach with 16 by 75 tables with little boxes, with little dimensions and payoffs and deliverables and this, that, and the other and all this kind of stuff. And we're like going, you know, we just need help to reach out to civil society in some of these regions. So it's an issue. But I would certainly suggest trying to engage with them. I'm in the group, the outreach group that Sally's running.
Great.
So, with that said, thank you, Brian, for coming. Thank you for waiting for 5 minutes. We just wanted to knock out a couple of agenda items, and we'd love to hear from PIR and what's up. And first of all, we have already acknowledged our grateful support to you for over the years for NCUC's work. And so we continue to thank you for that and just wonder what your thoughts are for today.
Thanks, Bill, and very happy to continue to provide support from Public Interest Registry. My name is Brian Cute. I'm the CEO of Public Interest Registry. Thank you very much for inviting me. I will try to be succinct and give you an update of what's up with us. PIR is, of course, the operator of the .org domain on the Internet, which has been serving the non-commercial community to a large degree for over 10 years. We are continuing to promote .org on a global basis, and in the last couple of years have put some focused programs in developing countries and Southern Hemisphere markets to make sure that .org is being made available to the broadest possible set of users. The most important new project for us, which some of you I hope have heard of, is the applications we made for the .ngo, .ong top-level domains. That is designed to serve non-governmental organizations. Both NGO and ONG, the Romance language equivalent, is going to be offered as a community-based top-level domain, uniquely designed to serve the NGO community globally. And they will also be offered as closed domains so that only NGOs will be able to register in those domains. We came to the conclusion that this was a good idea after doing about 18-plus months of outreach to NGOs around the world, holding a number of workshops and presenting this concept to the NGO community, both grassroots and larger and mid-size, and asking them whether there was a benefit here to be had. We heard a resounding yes, and in large part because the NGO community told us that the damage done by briefcase NGOs, fraudsters who set themselves up as NGOs, is real in their community. It has done damage to their reputation, and that if an online resource that in some way could be verified could be offered an address space where the donor or the user had a high sense that this was a bona fide NGO that they were interacting with, this would offer a distinct benefit to their community. So after doing a lot of outreach and getting strong affirmative response, we applied as a community-based TLD. We had over 700 letters of support from NGOs from around the world, and a very good geographic distribution too, both Northern Hemisphere, Southern Hemisphere, a good representation of the NGOs saying, yes, we think this is a good thing for Public Interest Registry to do. So where we are in that process is the early good news is that there was nobody else who applied, so we don't have a contention set. We are going through the ICANN evaluation process. If ICANN stays on its current calendar and track, anticipate launching those new addresses probably late first quarter or early second quarter of next year. And so in addition to continuing to promote robustandhealthy.org, we are very busy in the halls of Public Interest Registry trying to get ready to launch what we think are going to be very important new top-level domains. We did also apply for 4 IDN versions of .org, one in Hindi, one in Cyrillic, 2 in Chinese. We do have an objection against our Cyrillic application. We'll work through that process, but we also anticipate the launch of IDN versions of .org, as it's important, equally important to us to promote the growth of the multilingual internet around the globe. So that's really what's new with us, and happy to take any questions or discuss anything of interest.
Thank you, Brian. The Cyrillic case, what's the nature of the objection exactly?
It's an organization that's asserting a trademark right in the Cyrillic string that we've put forward, and so as it's a intellectual property legal-based objection, our lawyers are looking at it, assessing it. We're moving forward in the challenge process. We hope that we'll prevail there, but we are in the middle of that process.
Do you have an expression of support from the Kremlin for identifying true NGOs?
We haven't spoken to Vladimir yet. Oh, the other thing that I should point out, too, is we, in addition to doing a lot more outreach to NGOs in the coming months, we'll try to, again, raise the awareness as we lead toward launch. We have opened up an expression of interest list for NGOs who may want to get that name. And it's simply a matter of them indicating an interest, and we would provide them with updates on the program as we move closer and closer to launch. But we've gotten good responses there from some very notable NGOs around the world, and that's encouraging as well.
Fantastic. Hartmut.
In Brazil, to win the support for some second-level domains, we offer sometimes a period for free. When you are looking for the market in Latin America and Africa, do you see that you need to use a special grace period, reducing the prices, or make some advertising to win more members that will join the process? Is there any differentiation? Sometimes the price is, for some countries, some NGOs, let's say, not a high amount, but can be a barrier, can be any difficulty.
Thank you for the question.
Just to add to the what Glaser said, sometimes it's not even the price, it's how to pay for NGOs in Africa and so on.
So two aspects there. First, in terms of the price, we're keenly aware that the community we're serving is a community of NGOs and that there will be a price and cost sensitivity there. We're also aware that it's not just a domain name that gives them some value and visibility, but also a basic website at a minimum and some other services that get them online, visible, and interacting with their supporters. We're talking to the registrars that we work with so that we can provide as cost-effective an online package for NGOs. And certainly we have the ability to offer discount and rebate programs through the channel to try to make sure that it's getting to the entire community at the right cost level. With respect to payment issues, that is also an issue. One of our challenges, in addition to building a mechanism that allows us to provide some basic level of verification that an organization is an NGO, and that is a unique challenge, distribution and making sure it's available on a global basis in the Southern Hemisphere is something we're looking at. We're talking to the registrars, again, who we work with about language support, multilingual, different payment mechanisms. So it is a problem that is on our radar screen that we're trying to solve.
Rafiq.
Okay, thanks, Brian. About your last point about distribution, I think several strategies, either from Latin America or Africa or the ongoing one in Middle East and North Africa, is about having more registrar and building more stronger domain name space. I think that you have space to help that. And if not long a time ago, we have that talk about the support applicant that's more than the ICANN.NGO, but maybe you can think for the next round if you can really help for kind of pro bono support for those applicants for new GTLD if there is next round.
Thank you. And in terms of distribution, you're right. In some regions of the world, there's very little distribution infrastructure in terms of registrars. We're looking at that. We're looking at resellers and reseller channels. We're thinking about could perhaps NGO associations become distributors of NGO and ONG and trying to find the best way for the broadest possible distribution.
Can I just ask, I'm sure you've thought this all through and I just never talked to you about it. A large part of civil society is not formal legal NGOs at all. It's advocacy networks that have varying or no legal form in many cases. So what's their access like? What are there any special provisions that need to be made vis-a-vis them, or how do you deal with them?
So let me start at the high level on this. One thing Public Interest Registry is very aware of, and in term learnings from our engagement with the community, is that what we are is, and what we should be, is a neutral third-party steward of the TLD, and that it is not our job to determine who is or who is not an NGO. Very aware of that, and approaching the work from that perspective. In putting together a definition of an NGO, we did a lot of research and looked across all of the sources you might imagine, United Nations, governmental, community-based, regional, and established what we felt was a broad as possible definition of that term, knowing that when we get to verification, we're going to be doing that working with community organizations who maintain the data, working with different lists, be they governmental or from the community, and that the defining of that will come through the building of the verification process in a more clear sense. We do have an entity element in the definition. Clear recognition that there can be volunteer networks that don't have some formal entity around them. But there is an entity element in the definition, so that is one aspect that bounds it a bit. And again, we have to work with the lists that are available, the associations who have members, and any other community resource. It's going to be a combination of those types of lists or data points and then building a manual verification part of the mechanism. So if someone isn't on a list that's verifiable, can they present a document, some other piece of evidence? Can they get a referral from another NGO who is in good standing? So we are looking through all of those, and it's a challenge. We're open to suggestions as to how to solve this the best possible way, because we have to do it with the community.
In Brazil, we have .org.br. .org is second level, and we apply only for non-for-profit entities. For sure, if you go to the academia, you have scientific associations, non-for-profit, but they apply under .edu because they are academia. Or you use, let's say, industry federations, also not-for-profit, but behind them are the big industries, so they cannot apply for .org. So very easy for us to know if it's an entity that is non-for-profit, they need to prove by the bylaws that they are a non-for-profit entity and are not in other activities that can be in competition with social projects and this kind of relationship. And it's very easy. Carlos Afonso is one of the seats in our board for the non-for-profit entities and knows all the history.
Thank you. And so that's for the .org.br rules? Yeah. And so for us, as many of you probably know, .org itself is an open domain. So, and it's the large percentage of registrants in .org are non-commercial nonprofits, and that's where the brand value and the trust element of org come from, and that's a good thing. But it is open. So going with a closed domain on .ngo is where we're getting into the realm that you're describing. And so, again, if you have any suggestions, I'm wide open offline to think of how we can best do this. Thank you.
And we'll be doing a workshop on closed domains at the IGF, so you should hop along for that. We have Wendy. Did you have a question?
Yes, and just wondering whether there's another possible synergy here in that we in NCSG, NCUC are always looking for ways to get new folks to know about the possibilities to participate in ICANN. Are there ways that we might work with the .ngo or .ong to help promote the possibility of involvement in these constituencies and stakeholder groups?
Certainly. We're going to do effectively two waves of outreach. We've done the first, which was to validate that this was something that would give benefit to the community, roughly around mid-year this year, because we're assuming a early Q2 launch will be when we start to launch the second wave of outreach, and that's about building interest and getting the word out there. And so there may be some opportunities in our activities to work together to not only sensitize the NGOs to the fact that this is coming, but also what other opportunities that opens up for them. So that's a good suggestion.
Brian, I have a question. Have you ever taken a look at the distribution globally, maybe by country or by region, of .org addresses to see if there is a more equitable distribution than is present in a number of other TLDs?
Well, we've done the first, which is look at .org distribution, but not necessarily comparing to other TLDs. And generally speaking, there is still a higher concentration in North America and Europe for .org. And hence the programs we've been running in the last year and a half to promote adoption of org in the developing regions of the world is something that's a critical focus to us. So we're starting to see material shifts in that balance, and we're going to keep driving in that direction. Vis-a-vis the other TLDs, don't have any data on that, Glenn.
Great. Well, I'm glad to hear that the shifts are happening.
All right. Are there any last questions for Brian? Wilson? Wilson, and then somebody in the wall.
I want to ask any organizations that are not necessarily NGOs, but they appear like NGOs or are non-profit organizations like NCUC, ON, and NGO.
The question, again, was in with respect to organizations. I'm
organizations
sorry.
That are not necessarily NGOs, I imagine, are licensed by their respective governments, that they are non-profit organizations in that country. Mm-hmm. But NCUC is not licensed by any government. It's just a question under ICANN, mm-hmm. and it's non-profit. So can it apply for an NGO, for .ngo?
Yeah, the definition would be broad enough. Again, we tried to build a composite definition. We're not the authority. We went out and went to a number of different sources, but we built a very broad definition, you know, non-commercial, non-governmental, non-criminal. That's important. That's important.
And non-political.
sorry, guys. And also the definition speaks to the mission orientation, and there's a lot of good language there, but it is a broad definition, and in fact, you could qualify, but there's the verification element too. And that's something we have to have in place to make, because again, the promise and the benefit is that this is going to be an address on the internet where the donor, the user, the participant, the volunteer has that higher sense of trust that they're interacting with a genuine NGO.
Yes. Oh, okay. I just heard that non-criminal, probably. Like,
could you say who we are?
Artie, please, yeah, from Bangkok, Thai Netizen Network. For non-criminal, I'm not sure. A lot of NGOs do things that, like, we call, what we call it, civil disobedience, right? So that's a little bit. but my question is that I'm not sure whether this is going to be relevant to that dot, like the support for the .ngo or not. But like, would this be going to extend to the support for those like SSL certificates, or I'm not sure, or like just to promote security, whatever, or it would be like irrelevant in the like next 2 years when I don't know the DevSec whatever come in place. But like, just to keep in mind that whether it's going to be like extend to like SSL certificate and the requirement of like having like IP addresses or not to support the NGO. Thanks.
Well, in terms of requirements, new TLD registries, it's required that they be DNSSEC compliant. So .ngo and .ong will be DNSSEC compliant. With respect to certs or other things, again, what we're focused on is making sure that the NGOs have at least a good basic package of web hosting services and working with our partners to put that together. That, of course, could include SSL and would in many cases. So the answer is yes, DNSSEC is required. That's a good thing, and we will be DNSSEC compliant.
Okay, because we do need to wrap up this.
My big concern with all the new GTLDs program is that a lot of probably domain names will be protective. You need to register your company to avoid that some other use it. If we already have .org, and now you have two other new options, how do you see that all the .org clients today will react if they will request again to go to the new top-level domains to protect their names? Is there any special provision that you will help them to avoid to spend money only for protect their name?
Well, we have heard this question often, you know, if I have a .org, what do I do? And the way we are presenting it to them is this is really a choice. We are not looking, like perhaps some other actors, to force defensive registrations in .ngo and .ong. That's not what we're trying to do here. And frankly, if you've got a .org website and you've got a good web presence and it doesn't make sense for you, even if you could qualify for .ngo, then we're just as happy for you to stay on your .org and not make the shift.
But I don't like to see my name used. I have glaser.org, and yeah. Now someone will use glaser.ngo. I am not happy with this. How you protect me?
We are going to use a trademark clearinghouse, as all of us will with the new TLDs. There's no getting around that. But that's something we'd have to explore in terms of providing additional protections for .org registrants.
Okay, we have one more. We have 15 minutes left. This is Kathy. Yes, last question.
We've just heard a new issue raised, the trademark clearinghouse, and the use of it during Sunrise, which registries have some discretion over how to use the trademark clearinghouse and whether a trademark for shoes would apply for pre-registration in .ngo. Have you thought through this level of registration policy, and is there something you could share with them?
We are working through those policies right now with our legal team. And again, for .org registrants, because it's an open domain, there are some individuals in there who have a registered .org and lots of companies and lots of not-for-profits. So we don't have a clean parsing of the .org zone either. That's something that we need to do as we think through this, but we do not have a final policy. Happy to take suggestions, Kathy. Thank you. You know where to find David.
I believe we've reached a meeting of minds on that last point. Thank you very much for coming by. We really appreciate it and appreciate your support over the years.
Thanks very much, Bill. Thank you all.
Okay, it's getting late in the day, and everybody's thinking about lunch, but we do have one last item that's worth talking about. We knew we had a full agenda to go through, and this was saved to the end, and it was either going to be, depending on how the day went, a long ontological discussion or a brief prolegomenon. So I guess it's going to be a prolegomenon. It's going to be an introduction. We need to redo the bylaws for NCUC. They are significantly out of date. If you were to look at the website, they are several years old, and they describe an organization that does not exist. They describe an organization that takes dues, that has a policy committee, that just in a lot of ways doesn't comport terribly well with who we are and how we're actually operating. So one of the things that we clearly need to do in the next quarter, I would think, by the summer, would be to try to redraft the bylaws. And I had a little conversation here on the side with Rob Hogarth, who was telling me that there's a big push coming from the board now to make sure that all the bylaws of all the constituencies and other entities are going to be completely consistent across ICANN. So that will add to another level then. We have to make sure that everything we do is completely consistent with the NCSG charter and also consistent with whatever it is the ICANN board is now thinking about how the bylaws should look. So these are factors that are going to require a lot of collective work going forward. Ideally, though, if we were to be able to revise the bylaws by the summer, we could have a vote on them to adopt them prior to the next election of people to fill slots. If we can't get it together, then we would have to do it at the same time that we do the election for the slots in the fall. And the main issue there, I would think, is the following. One of the points that I've raised, and I know there are different views on this, has to do, for example, with the composition of the executive committee. Right now we have an executive committee that's defined by regional representation. One of the interesting things about that, of course, is that nobody really represents the regions, and that the regional representatives historically have not done much of anything. And so what we've been trying to do with this current push to rejuvenate the executive committee was to create functional roles associated with task committees that would actually do stuff. So that instead of standing for, I will represent all of Asia, which of course you're not really going to do, you would stand for, I want to direct the outreach effort, or I want to be the facilitator of the budgetary committee. To ask people to vote to stand for particular functional roles that are associated with open teams that would work on getting these things done, so that all of the kinds of functions that have not been performed on a consistent basis, in which we're trying now to post hoc catch up and refresh, could on an ongoing basis be done collaboratively with people who have stood up and said, yes, I am willing to serve as leader of that particular effort. Now, some people agree with me on doing that, and some people don't. If we were to decide that that was the way we wanted to do it, then we're redefining the positions people are standing for election in the fall. That would mean you need to adopt the change in the summer, you see, so that people could stand for different positions in the fall. Another way, of course, you could do this would be to stick with the regional thing, but simply operate on the expectation that everybody who's elected to a regional slot will take one of these functional slots and will take command and lead something. A lot of different ways of dealing with this. Now, we've got the nub of a team, four or five people who've expressed interest in joining. If there are other people who'd like to join that team, again, it's accessible through the web page. But it ties into the general point of, you know, how do we want to build the organization going forward? And we have to have, you know, we have to have bylaws that comport with who we are. The other point that's really a big one that's outstanding is the policy committee. The NCUC charter bylaws says we have a policy committee. We don't. Right now, policy work has been done on a very ad hoc basis over the years. People have said at various points on the members list, hey, I'll draft something. What do people think? And then something would get drafted, nobody objected to it, and it would get posted as an NCUC statement in a public comment period or into a working group or something like that. Or else those things have been fed into the policy committee of the NCSG to be considered by NPOC as well for adoption at the stakeholder group level. Either way, we've been operating in a very loosey-goosey way. Now, we can either say we shouldn't have a policy committee and we just do all the policy work through the stakeholder group, which to me would be at odds with the whole history going back to 1999 of NCUC having a particular identity and so on, Or we could try to create some sort of a more structured, principle-based way of doing policy, whether it's a standing committee with members or it's a defined process led by somebody of reaching out to posting things and waiting for replies and whatever. It has to be specified in the bylaws what we're going to do. So it can be a kind of a virtual thing drawing in all the members. It can be a small group of people who opt in and join. There are a lot of different ways of thinking about it. But right now, we've got a bylaw that says this is how we do things, and we don't. And so that is something that we clearly want to take on board in the next few months. So I would strongly encourage everybody who has an interest in thinking about how does NCUC want to position itself in relationship to the stakeholder group, in relationship to the workflow, what kind of visibility does it want to have, identity does it want to have, etc., and how, in particular, should we structure our processes to join the group that's going to be trying to revise the bylaws and help us do it in a proper way. And with that, I shut up, and we've got a few minutes for discussion. Any thoughts on any of the issues that are raised? I see David and Tapani and Milton. Just to go. Let's start with you guys. And then Robin.
Okay. Certainly the fact that we don't have a formal policy committee, that provision was put into the charter before there was the NCSG with the NCSG policy committee. So that may be that it simply is redundant for historical reasons that we do have a formal process at the NCSG level, and that may be all we need. It's certainly, however, a less formal focused policy group that might come in. I also just want to say I'm wary of going too far down the putting functional roles into the charter path. The charter is a very difficult to change document. It's extraordinarily, it requires a lot of organisation to change it. It may in fact actually fail, not because of if there's any actual opposition to it, that would be another thing. But even just if everybody's in favour of charter changes, it can still quite easily fail to achieve the voting minimums to happen. So I'm very wary of putting things like functional roles into the charter, because if our operating procedures and so on change over time, we're then stuck with it. To some extent, the roles that absolutely aren't going to change, like finance and so on, are one thing, but roles that might very well change is another story. And we can certainly create functional roles without having to put them in the charter. We can just decide, okay, the exec committee has decided we now have our whatever, and that's all we need. We don't need to have a charter. We can make, we could create whatever we want to call them, bylaws or regulations or any rules outside the charter that document our operating procedure. Mm-hmm. And I think that idea of having a less lightweight set, a much more lightweight set of rules that we can flexibly change, but that cover really, it's really our own internal organisation. What does it matter to the rest of ICANN? So if it doesn't matter to the rest of ICANN, why do we need to put it in a formal charter? Why can't we just have it as our ongoing rules?
Okay, just first a quick practical point for joining the teams at the moment is simply subscribing to the mailing lists. So look at lists.ncuc.org, which you can see up there now, and subscribe that way. Otherwise, for the functional teams, I pretty much want to echo David. I'm rather worried that I'd be elected on, so somebody's elected to do a certain job and then this person disappears. And when we'll have to figure out how to sort that out, that a bit more flexible way that you can change roles and ranks during the year would be useful.
Uh-huh. We had Rafiq and then Casinos and Robin. Sorry, Milton.
Robin, Rafiq, and
Vlad. Everybody raise their hand once. Okay, sorry. Milton, Robin, Rafiq, Casinos.
Good job. Former chair duties showing up there, yeah. So a lot of the cruft that you see in the bylaws is a consequence of the fact that the stakeholder group thing was kind of imposed on us from the top, mm-hmm. And we had a big discussion or battle about what would be. We didn't want to have constituencies. We kind of were assuming we would just throw out the constituency stuff when we had the stakeholder group, and the staff didn't want us to do that ultimately, but they compromised with us. So there's a lot of confusion there. I think I want to address a specific issue after saying that I think David's attitude is the correct principle. The way to approach this is, you know, unless it really has operational consequences, don't mess with it. We don't have to formalize everything to actually have it functional. But I think Bill has some good ideas about, in particular, the nature of the executive committee. When the executive committee was first created, it was in the early days of ICANN, and there was a lot of concern among non-U.S. entities, not just in our constituency but elsewhere, that, you know, the whole thing was too U.S. dominated. And we were making a point at that time by having our executive committee be geographically representational, that every, you know, part of the world would be represented on our executive committee. It may be the case that with the broader representation that we've achieved in NCUC, that's no longer necessary, and that we simply want, we will get diversity anyway, and the people should be coming in and volunteering for a specific function. I actually like that idea that the executive committee are people who are, you know, this is our communications person, this is our finance person. I like that idea. and we can just trust ourselves and our members to vote, and that the volunteers will be diverse and the voting population will put the right person in there regardless of where they're from.
And you can have a distributional requirement.
You could. That was the other thing, is that you made this point yourself, that you could just say, well, keep the executive committee as it is, but when you're running now, we're saying, what are you going to do on the executive committee? What part, what function are you running for? And in that regard, again, recall what David said about getting too specific with the charter or the bylaws, given how hard it is to change them. The GNSO is going to go through another review in a couple of years, right? So good luck with that, suckers. I'll be gone. But
So this may have to be a standing committee.
Or a sitting committee, for depending on how tired their legs get. But there's another point I wanted to make. I'm trying to recall what it is. I'll give out the microphone.
Okay. Robin?
Thank you. I wanted to answer your question, or at least provide my input in your question about policy and where policy should be done. I think it needs to be done at both levels. We know that the broader stakeholder group has a lot of policy obligations in our charter, and our counselors are elected at the stakeholder group level and have policy obligations there. However, I think it's also very important that constituencies also work on policy, and in some ways can have an opportunity to be more effective, because, you know, oftentimes at the stakeholder group level, we're really focused on what we're doing on council that week, and you know, not everyone cares about the IRTP, whatever, and people don't engage in that. But I think that the constituency has an opportunity to say, okay, what's the issue, or some issues that we really care about and we really want to focus on it and drill down into. So, you know, for example, NCUC could have a webinar on who is privacy, and I think that would be fabulous, and I think that could then feed into the SG. That's my view, is I think that the constituencies must be doing policy, should be doing policy, and in some ways have the opportunity to be doing the more interesting and the more to work on the policies that are of greater impact to the interests of our constituents. That's all I'm going to say.
And should we think in terms of a fixed committee with fixed people, or more open structures? What I'm struggling with.
Well, I think there should be a fixed committee, because there has to be some way of people giving approval that something is an NCUC statement, so there has to be some kind of process by which that happens, and a committee can manage that. But at the same time, I think it also, we have to have an opportunity for a sort of an open opportunity for anyone to participate and anyone to just work on a policy issue and work with the committee on these issues. So that would be my view.
Let me float it out. Okay. Trying to remember the order of you, and I'm sorry, it's been a long day. Rafiq.
So this is Rafiq speaking. Coming after all these folks, so I will overlap in what I am going to say. But so I think I'm in agreement with Milton that we need more to specify about the mission, that what kind of role, and to define in details, but not really giving a specific position, not elected or appointed, to appoint someone. And I think the EC has a role to manage the process of joining Robin in that. So the EC will help to manage the process. It can be someone from the EC taking the role, but also to open that to the whole membership so we can engage more members. So we have an ad hoc constitution and also a process in play that can help us to make decision at the end. Otherwise, it will be an endless. And at the same time, we need to make to have a stronger NCUC in making more statement, to be involved in the policy and so on. And so sometimes we need to hurry up, to not wait for our counterpart to make decision. And the third point about the GNSU review, in fact, is coming soon. And I think we will have a discussion soon with the SIC. So, and they will assess about our openness and transparency and accountability and so on. So that's another process that we have to care about. It's kind of take, I think, a bank chunk of our bandwidth. But so we need to see if we, so I think we need to work with Robert to see how we can maybe to both the changing bylaws otherwise. It's not easy to engage our membership on that issue.
Right. Okay. Was it Wendy and Constantinos?
Thanks, Wendy Seltzer. I'm now totally confused about where we actually get to do policy discussion. But it seems that we went from the overlap of redundant discussions of policy in both NCUC and NCSG to no discussions of policy in either NCUC or NCSG on Constituency Day. A brief policy meeting yesterday where we covered the council items but not additional items on the agenda. I think there is a lot that we need to do to put a positive policy agenda forward so that we don't keep on getting swept up in the last-minute response to public comments about how we're being ignored, but haven't put our concerns on the table beforehand. So where shall we do these things for Durban? Because and where shall we do them online between now and Durban? Because I'm finding it difficult to see in the proliferation of lists. It's great to have an NCUC specific list, but where do we focus our attention so that we get policy positions developed and then forwarded through the most effective channel possible?
I would suggest the NCSG Policy Committee, of which you're the chair. There's a committee. That's the only place that exists right now in the structure, and we're debating whether within the constituency we can do something that would support and feed into that. But right now, that's what we have.
Excellent. I call a policy committee meeting parallel to every other meeting, and meet me in the back.
Fantastic.
Very briefly, I think there is consensus in here that the charter needs to be changed, and it's a good thing that you are starting this process. One thing that I think it's a recurring theme from everybody who has been speaking today about this issue is that First of all, I would recommend don't rush it. I mean, I started at some point, but because there are elections coming up, do not try to have the charter before the election. So you do, you know, the new councillors are under the new charter. Just find the time, set try to set a reasonable deadline. That is, even if it's a year, because the charter needs to be relevant, and we need to try to make the charter relevant in the next 10 years. I hadn't realized that the GNSO will be restructured so soon. I thought that, this will take more time. So God only knows what ICANN has in the cards for everybody, especially for constituencies. The EC, I prefer the idea of having, and I see that you have already kickstarted the process of outreach, communications people, rather than, we definitely need to have someone from Europe or Latin America, because then, again, it was becoming difficult getting people from these regions. I think that people have interest in areas like communications and outreach, rather than it will be easier to find those people. And for the PC, I also think that it needs to be done at the level of the constituency, because the constituencies might get bigger. You might have NCSG with plenty of constituencies. Right now, NCSG has councillors from NCUC, so it works. At some point, NCSG might not have councillors from NCUC. So where will be the voice of NCUC if you don't have a policy committee on these issues? And in order to attract them, you might actually want to start, and this is, of course, putting pressure on ICANN to give funding for these people to come. The people who are working on policy, they need to be able to be funded to come to these meetings and speak, because those will be the people who will, and if you promise them attendance, then you will see them engaging and possibly even submitting the comments.
Very good. Thank you. I'm sure everybody wants to go eat, but Kathy, yes?
Oh, I'm holding everybody up.
Well, no.
Me and
there may be one or two others, but...
Okay. I just had a strange thought I wanted to throw out there about the policy committee and policy issues generally, which is that we may want to organize in a slightly different way. There are some constituencies that want to cover every issue all the time. The registries and registrars will do that, for example. They make sure that that the industry is represented on everything. We tend to come in slightly differently. We care about certain principles, certain core values, and when those are threatened, that's when we galvanize. So is there something on the policy committee? Should we be thinking about having people who can help us identify what issues in ICANN threaten or can help improve our core values, and help identify which proceedings we need to pay attention to and which ones we don't need to monitor as closely? Mm-hmm. Identify those and then try to tap them. Can the policy committee be kind of thinking about something a little more broadly, mm-hmm. and more, rather than assigning certain people who always have to respond to everything, regardless of whether they're interested or not, find certain people who are really, really concerned about free speech and freedom of expression, certain people really concerned about privacy and data protection, not just concerned, but expert, and then reach out to them if and then have certain people monitoring, like our counselors know exactly what's going through because they're approving charters. So how do we set up our own early warning systems and then figure out who has time and some expertise to work on issues? It's a slightly different approach rather than just systematically assigning people who are always responsible for certain things.
And you sort of raised an issue like that in L.A. as well when we were talking about whether it would be, if we wanted to have any kind of funded assistance, should it only be administrative or should they have some role in sort of like the front end of policy stuff too? And there was a lot of different feelings about that, as you remember. So this is a difficult issue.
But sorry, different feelings about whether our working group people should be funded to come?
Whether their staff could play the kind of role you're talking about, or whether that would be something volunteers
sorry,
would
Bill,
do.
Bill, with respect, very, very different issues. Whether we have staff writing up minutes as a draft is a totally different issue than organizing the policy committee based on certain types of values and principles to help do early warning as new ICANN working groups are formed. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
Okay.
Apples and oranges?
They were chopped together in LA.
If I understand the point of Kathy, I think she's talking about community management. If we know better our members in their interest, then we can engage them in those specific issues more easily.
Well, we don't have the committee now to do that, but The question is, if we should, then that certainly can go that way, yeah. Carlos.
Thanks. We have a tremendous opportunity. We are the bottom of the bottom-up model. We're the lowest form of life in this hotel. We can probably ask Fadi about that. But what we have the opportunity to do is have a really open policy committee. Yes, we have a leadership that may have to vote and have official positions. But we can welcome in new members and engage them immediately in policy. We bring in IP, Professor Kathy. We can put them on a policy committee looking at an IP issue. We can generate our own proposals. So often here, we're just reacting to others' fires. And I actually thought, I'd say, we can be the arsonist. But then Wendy came up with a great idea last night that we can actually propose some positive change. And if we have a very open, expansive policy committee, not in competition with the stakeholder group, but in addition as a complement, I think we can do some pretty neat stuff.
Very quickly, this is Carlos Alfonso. Just to second Kathy's and Ed's a comment on that, definitely if we could have a sort of an open policy team that would cluster around some issues, it would be interesting, especially because there is a sort of a branding or marketing thing that we are not quite using that much, which is the fact that we have a bunch of professors here on the very prestigious academic institutions represented in this room, for instance, and we have people who have this awesome experiences on issues like privacy, free speech, and IP, and we could definitely use that. And when I thought about IP, I was thinking about you, Constantinos. But we definitely could use our, this, let's say, open or expanded policy team as a sort of a showcase of the people and the expertise that we have in this room, and on the counterpart of that, which is the, which are the GNSO counselors. Like, probably the greatest challenge that I faced when I was GNSO counselor representing NCUC is that you will needed to be a generalist of some sort, that you had to be on the table and discuss with some degree of expertise on some issues that probably you wouldn't have like took the time during your life to study or to research that much. So that's truly a task for the GNSO counselors, and it's good that they are aware of that. But on the policy council level, that will be definitely important for us to try to use this amount of experience and expertise that we have on the team, on the constituency as well.
Yes, Kathy.
And just a note to feed back into what Ed said and Carlos said, this ability to focus on the issues. I like the three you identified, privacy, free speech, intellectual property, and I'll add fair use to intellectual property slash fair use. This ability to profile both our experts and to bring new people in, this is resume builders for people coming in. These are areas people are excited about. These are areas that are big. To invite them to come in to the ground floor of a working group working on these issues for the internet may actually become a positive, not a negative, if we can work with them, use senior people to help mentor and spend time and talk about not just the substance but how you work within a working group. There's all sorts of ways now to channel this energy into our engagement and our outreach. I think this is a great direction.
Okay. Fair enough. That will require people and capacity, but it's certainly doable, and it's certainly a model that would help us be more engaged and effective if we can make it happen.
Our web address again, yeah, for anybody that will join us is
ncuc.org, I would think.
No, well, NCUC, our email address is ncuc@ncuc.org. If you have ideas, you want to join us, you have friends that want to join us, we need help. Please, thank you.
So, I need help with lunch. There's cheap food readily available right downstairs, actually, which is quick. What time does NCSG start? 1:30. So we have 40 minutes. So you can either run through the hallway to the shopping mall across the way and eat Chinese, or just grab a sandwich downstairs. Thank you, everybody, for participating.
Is there any good Chinese over there?
Yes.